is time to put away the bias, the lies, and deceit and bring forth real talk from real people about real news. Providing the out loud truth and capturing the essence of a new generation all in a fast-paced hour. This is Viewpoint This Sunday.
Welcome to another Viewpoint This Sunday. This is Malcolm Out Loud.
I have great faith in Nancy Pelosi and the job that the House Democrats did in the House. I have great faith in the House managers and the job they did. When we look back, I think the thing that we are most gratified about is we knew this was an uphill fight. We knew you need two-thirds to convict. We know that the president is a vindictive, nasty president who goes after anyone who opposes him. And we know that Republicans, even those who might know better, want to go in line with him. Let fairness ring. Americans know that Democrats are for a fair trial and witnesses and documents are needed. And they know that Republicans are opposing even that. So we're very gratified about how this has moved forward. It's, you know, we're not in the majority. We have a president who strikes fear in the hearts of Republicans.
Chuck Schumer, and you hear some of the comments from him right up front there. Obviously, the big story is the impeachment. There is a lot of other news as well, which we will talk about today. But let's start with this impeachment business right there. There are a couple of big takeaways that Chuck Schumer talks about there. And I want to get into those as we bring a panel discussion here. And let me bring on the program. Colonel Jim Warshak is here. He's retired from United States Air Force. He is a career senior intelligence and special missions officer. Former Deputy Director of Intelligence at U.S. Central Command and served on the White House National Security Council staff as intelligence aide to the National Security Advisor. Michael Johns is here. He's the national co-founder and leader of the Tea Party movement, a former White House speechwriter and a policy analyst with the Heritage Foundation. And Dr. Carol Swain joins us. She's an award-winning political scientist, a former professor of political science and professor of law at Vanderbilt University. She's the author of 8 books and host of Be the People. It's a show program you can hear right here on America Out Loud on our network, friends. All right, 2 big takeaways there, guys, on the impeachment I want to talk to you about here. And one of the things that Chuck Schumer says here, and I quote, "We know the president is a nasty, vindictive president who goes after anyone who opposes him." Now, part of the talk that we'll get into here is, you know, was there grounds for this impeachment or not? Was there really grounds as the Senate is now moving on this thing here? When you hear the minority leader put that out there about a vindictive president, you almost have to stop a moment and ask yourself, what does that really mean? Are they trying to impeach the president of the United States because he is nasty and a vindictive president? Now, I've been thinking about this a lot. Colonel Jim, let me get you to start with this here. I've been thinking about this a bit here, and I don't think it has a lot to do with that particular Ukraine call, quite frankly. I think it has to do with a lot of other things, including, as I've spoke about on my other programs, the judges and the spine of the country that this president is changing. But really, what the left is doing here, they don't like his nastiness, they don't like his vindictiveness, but those are not grounds, Jim, that you can impeach a president for. You have to go to the, you have to go to the ballots. You have to go to We the People. I think they got it all wrong. What do you think?
Well, absolutely. From the very beginning, and we saw and heard many of those on the Democratic Party side talk about impeachment, some even prior to him taking office and certainly after he took office. This whole thing for them has been grasping for straws to try to find something that fit the bill of high crimes and misdemeanors, and they didn't. They finally came down to after Mueller trial and the House investigations and everything else going after him on what I like to say is due diligence on the Ukraine issue to ensure we were giving aid properly to a corrupt or formerly corrupt government, that the president as the commander in chief and head of our country has all the right to do. He determines national security and foreign policy.
Senators Rob Portman of Ohio and Marco Rubio of Florida suggested that Trump's call was inappropriate, though they did not support conviction. And that's been some of the words we've been hearing. Also, one of the big votes that kind of came in here the other day, Senator Lamar Alexander, Republican out of Tennessee, said, quote exactly what he said, but the Constitution does not give the Senate the power to remove the president from office and ban him from this year's ballot simply for actions that are inappropriate. So, Michael Johns, there are 2 points here I want to make with you. Number one, I think there's something to Schumer's talk. This, what I just played for listeners up front, was just said yesterday on Saturday. It was just said that where the minority leader got up there and made these comments. And when he says that, you know, the president's nasty, vindictive president, I really got the sense that that's why they're impeaching him, Michael. I really feel like that's right. What they're saying, which doesn't make a lot of sense to me. In fact, quite frankly, it's frustrating. But then, so there's that question. And then this other one where some of these senators are coming in saying, listen, this is not a perfect call. It was inappropriate, but we're not going to impeach the president over it. What do you say to that?
Well, if I look at the Schumer comments, I mean, I kind of, firstly, you know, those are meticulously chosen words at a very politically sensitive moment. So you really got to sort of dissect what he's saying. Number one, Schumer says that he's very pleased with the way Nancy Pelosi handled the impeachment proceedings in the House. Let's just break that down and talk about what, you know, actually did transpire there. Number one, as it relates to witnesses, they called their witnesses. They put their witnesses under deposition in that closed room in the basement that was not open to many Republicans, was not open to the media, and Republicans were not permitted to ask questions. They, in the actual public component of the proceedings, only called a few witnesses. The witnesses that they called, which I've mentioned before, it's important to run down. They had Ambassador to Ukraine, Taylor. He said he could not identify an impeachable offense. They had George Kent, who is the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Europe and Eurasia at States, that never even spoke to the President of the United States. These were prime witnesses, okay?
Right.
Never spoke to the President. Fiona Hill from the NSC said she never heard Trump reference anything on Ukraine aid. David Hale, the Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs, said he was unaware of any nefarious activities. Colonel Vindman, remember, he was like their lead guy. He was the one who was going to lay this whole case out. He said, nope, couldn't really see any basis for any allegation of bribery, which kind of gets to the core of what would be a high crime and misdemeanor.
Right.
Ambassador Volker, he was ambassador to NATO, said there was no quid pro quo, very emphatic about that. And the only real witness who, in my judgment, holds, you know, real tangible relevance here was Tim Morrison from the NSC, who was on the call. And he said, I was on the call and nothing was wrong. So that was the way Nancy Pelosi handled it. She brought forward no compelling evidence or witnesses. In fact, just the opposite. I think that the broad case for exoneration was made in the House, and this never should have made it to the Senate. Then it's the second part of it. Schumer goes on and says, we know that the president is vindictive and what other adjectives he used there.
Right.
That, here's my sense on that. I think that is designed, that is highly politicized language designed to tell the country, look, these Republicans who are going to vote to exonerate Trump would probably not be voting this way if he weren't that way. So it's designed to put a political dimension on what is an open and closed case.
Dr. Carol Swain, you can't even use the word hypocrisy because it does not do this justice at all. Well, let me say this. The other big takeaway that Schumer was saying there is he says Americans know that Democrats are for a fair trial. Now, I almost fell on the floor and ruptured a couple of veins when he said that, Carol, when I heard that. And he said, therefore, what a fair trial, and that witnesses and documents are needed. But as Michael just pointed out, you had the witnesses and documents in the House and you didn't do what you were supposed to do. Now you want a fair trial in the Senate? And that is actually one of the biggest talking points I've been hearing in the last 48 hours, Carol, is about fair trial, fair trial, fair trial. They don't feel like they got a fair trial. What do you say to that?
Say that they are trying to be clever by half and erase the memory from the American people of how unfair the House process was. And as far as the accusation that the president is vindictive, and I would say that the president understands the Democratic strategies of Saul Alinsky, and he gives them the ridicule back that they usually dish out. And so they're not accustomed to someone giving them back tit for tat what they dish out.
Well, Carol, this president broke the mold of a traditional, what they considered was a traditional president that they normally put in there. So when Chuck Schumer comes out and says he's nasty, vindictive president, basically what's happening, Carol, is the president calls it like he sees it. He's an umpire that calls balls and strikes to the entire political process. Now, you and I both have seen the president call Republicans out. We've actually heard him do things like that where we've said, did he really say that? Yeah, he really said that. And he'll like call anybody out on a moment's notice. But Carol, they're not used to that in Washington, are they?
They're definitely not accustomed to that in Washington. And he is the greatest threat to the system that they've set up. And so he is a clear and present danger to the swamp.
Yeah, yeah. God, that is really it, guys. I mean, that is it. Everybody listening knows what we're talking about here. So I just want you to understand, when the Democrats come out, my friends, and they start talking about fair trial, you now know what that's really all about. And the fact that they're calling the president nasty and vindictive, I can, you know, transcribe there for you in saying he's being honest and truthful to a point. And quite frankly, there's a lot of Americans, and certainly middle America, that's ready for that, because it's something a lot of people would call refreshing. We haven't seen that before by Washington standards. That's one of the attractions people would argue about for this president. But it's exactly what's driving the left crazy. They're going out of their minds. They don't know how to deal with this. And so I think the other takeaway, people, I want to talk about here now is that, listen, all right, the call for witnesses, first off, was rejected. Oh, my God. Thank God. I don't think anybody wanted this to go through. 5149, Lisa Murkowski, the Republican out of Alaska. She was that kind of hanging vote there. It's always the same cast of characters, if you notice, people. She says, and I quote, "The House chose to send articles of impeachment that are rushed and flawed. to say the least, right? I carefully considered the need for additional witnesses and documents to cure the shortcomings of its process, but ultimately decided that I will vote against considering motions to subpoena." Now, that was the magic message right there that put the 51. And of course, had it been 50-50, we'd have been in the fight with the Supreme Court, which is not supposed to break the tie, but the left was certainly pushing for that. Now, to bring everybody up to date here, they're adjourned until closing arguments on Monday. The senators will have their comments and their 10 minutes of fame on Tuesday, and a final vote on Wednesday. All of this is happening in the face of a State of the Union speech, which is scheduled for Tuesday, which we'll come back and talk about that in a moment. Coming into all of this now, when we talk about the fair trial, Colonel Warshak, bring it back to now where we sit right now. Here's what I'm thinking. If we get by the State of the Union, and we both know there could be a lot of shenanigans coming through that, we'll talk about that in a moment, and into Wednesday, into the final vote, and if the president is indeed acquitted, which it looks like that will be the case here, the question really now is this. What's going to change? What's going to change, Jim? And I think what we need to all realize on this call right now at this moment, what everybody needs to understand, all Americans, is that, is it fair to say that nothing's going to change in the next, if the president is reelected, the next 5 years, nothing's going to change. There's just going to be more crises and more drama and trauma coming from Washington, Jim. What's going to change?
Well, I think it's actually going to get worse because of the desperation on the part of the Democrats and the political left. Over the next 3 days, going into Wednesday when they do the vote, we're going to see, breaking news, another bombshell. Every day we're going to have a new bombshell over the next couple of days. And then they're going to perhaps use the State of the Union as an opportunity, even though it's just the president's time in front of the Congress.
With that State of the Union going on right there, and if something else happens, as you suggest right there, what I'm also wondering is, why didn't the Senate Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell, pull rank and pull out all the stops to bring this thing to a conclusion and get the president acquitted? And what is the reason? He could have done that. He did have the means.
I think that he could have, but that would have given the Democrats more fodder to complain. I believe that they're taking 10 minutes to stand, you know, in the well and complain about
the president. So what?
That is disastrous. That it would be disastrous for them because.
But they're going to complain no matter what, Carol. If we, in other words, if we give them an inch, they're going to take a mile. Don't you think so?
No, I don't. I don't. I think that letting them get up there and drone on for 10 minutes, you know, repeating the same talking points again and again and again, I believe the American people have impeachment fatigue. And you can see that in the fact that the viewership of the impeachment proceedings
down,
has been so
down.
Low, and it's continually.
Do you think it was
down.
The wise move for McConnell to do that, Carol?
I think so. I mean, I would have preferred personally for it to have been over, but I see this as torture, and so the American people are being tortured so that the senators can get their 10 minutes of fame.
Michael, back to what we're talking about here. Could McConnell have got the president acquitted before the State of the Union? Yes or no?
I think he could have, but I think politically that he made the right decision in allowing the process to go forward. One of the allegations against the president was obstruction of justice. He didn't want to give the Democrats a talking point that the president obstructed justice, and then the Senate, you know, sort of jumped on top and continued to obstruct identifying the truth here. So, you know, so the president's going to be able to stand Tuesday at the State of the Union and address the country and say that he fully, that this was a witch hunt and that he fully expects complete exoneration in the following 24
hours. I'll tell you,
hours.
That's going to be some State of the Union, Michael. That's a double popcorn and a double bottle of wine night. You know that, man, okay? Listen, all right, you hear Carol, you hear Michael there say that they think that he did the right thing, potentially, McConnell. I want to get it back for one last closing comment on this topic from you, Jim.
I agree with both positions. Yes, it could have been done, but this gives the opportunity one more time, and this is important, for the Republicans to get 3 days worth of sound bites of the Democrats whining and complaining how nothing was fair and everything was fair. And it's going to come back on Election Day to a number of senators, and these sound bites are going to be used in the campaigns against them.
One of the next big stories I want to talk to you all about is this coronavirus. And we're talking here, this is an infectious disease that experts are thinking now, some of the reports are, that over 12,000 people have the infection, and more than 250 have died. But we're also seeing reports on this coronavirus. I seen a report just yesterday here from the China South Morning Post, that say more than 75,000 people are infected with this virus. Now, here's a couple of interesting stats about the coronavirus I want you all to have. And this is interesting. There is a 1 in 50 chance of dying from this virus here. If you get this coronavirus, you have a 1 in 50 chance of dying from this. And to put that in perspective with the normal flu, if you've got the normal flu, the regular flu, the chances are 1 in 1,000. So I didn't know that, but 1 in 1,000 with just the everyday flu, and a lot of people die from the flu, believe it or not, or this coronavirus, 1 in 50. So the bottom line is, it's a deadly virus, is the bottom line if you get this thing. And the problem is, it has a long period of incubation, people. So the problem is, you won't know that you have it when you have it. And you're not sick when you first transmit it to others. And that's the big hype here, the problem that health experts are dealing with that's made this a crisis. Now, the World Health Organization has declared the outbreak a global public health emergency. United States officials have called it a public health emergency. And President Trump has gotten some flack from that, from the Chinese here. Michael Johns, I want to go to you first on this and talk about, I see comments coming in here overnight from China. They're being very critical article, and they actually said, their words were, that President Trump's remarks about this coronavirus were unfriendly comments, is what Beijing is saying. Unfriendly comments, they call them, Michael. They were trying to keep it more under wraps. I don't know. What do you think about the real numbers on this thing? And did President Trump do the right thing?
Yeah, unfriendly is grossly unfair. I don't think this is an issue of the of anything being, I mean, friendly, I presume, would be to minimize this and to misrepresent the reality of the seriousness of it, which, of course, would be an immense disservice. That in all possibility, actually would be an impeachable offense. But, you know, the thing that's most troubling here is the United States Center for Disease Control that really houses some of the world's leading experts on communicable diseases, and particularly on respiratory-related diseases, of which this is one, offered assistance to China all the way back on January 6th. So that's almost a month ago. Mm-hmm. And they were rejected and still have been rejected. So while they have World Health Organization personnel in there, many of whom are Chinese residents and citizens, the great expertise of CDC is not being utilized. And that, to me, is that might be the unfriendly step here, because I think the obviously the global interest, and certainly American interest, is to contain this virus. As far as the reaction from the standpoint of immigration issues and airlines in Europe and the United States suspending flights, that also seems entirely justifiable. When you have a virus that is this highly communicable and this potentially deadly, and particularly deadly with patients who may already have some compromised health issues.
I want to bring in to talk more about this coronavirus also with us Ilana Friedman. Ilana will be on a little later in the program when we address the Middle East peace plan as well. Ilana, you as an intelligence analyst follow this very closely. You've written some very profound pieces about the coronavirus on America Out Loud. Back to the point of the Chinese being direct or honorable with the information, and did President Trump do the right thing? So the first question is, what are your sources saying, and what are the real numbers behind this thing, Ilana?
First, say that I was really angry when I heard the World Health Organization congratulate the Chinese for their outstanding cooperation and openness. It's really the opposite. The Chinese have been lying and covering up from the beginning. And we know that the statistics from China have been underreported, misreported, or not reported at all. So here's what we know. The virus first appeared in China sometime in mid to late November. It wasn't reported publicly until the end of December. That was more than a month later. Mm-hmm. And then the Chinese stated that the source was an open-air meat market, and they knew it was not. 3 years ago, Nature magazine wrote an article about how China had built a level 4 biohazard lab in the city of Wuhan. The Chinese said that the lab was intended to, quote, study, quote, the SARS virus and Ebola. Now, a level 4 lab is the highest level of containment for the handling of biohazard materials. It has very, very strict protocols. What China did not reveal was what has been verified by people who were working in the lab at the time. And what they said was that they were working on a project to weaponize the SARS virus.
Wow.
That means that the virus would be stronger, mm-hmm, and far more dangerous, that it would spread faster, it would mutate faster, and that ultimately it would be more lethal. And then sometime during the second half of November, and we don't know exactly when, there was an accident in the lab in which a vial containing the weaponized coronavirus was dropped and shattered on the floor, and the virus was carried, maybe on somebody's clothing, or maybe one or more people in the lab became infected from the accident, and the virus was released into the city of Wuhan.
And you believe that's how it started?
That's the information, the intelligence that I've gotten is that's exactly the way it started, and it was very specific.
Ilana, what are the numbers that you're hearing from your sources? What are they? What's real?
The numbers are extraordinary. As of January 31st, there was an official count in China And they said 9,692 confirmed cases of infected individuals in China, which was, by the way, up 200 from the official count the day before, and more than 250 deaths. But unofficially, there have been unconfirmed reports of as many as 500,000 dead and 20 million people infected. As I say, these are unconfirmed reports, and there's a reason for that. The coroners and the doctors are so overwhelmed by the numbers that are being presented at the hospitals that they stopped counting, essentially. They just said, okay, this guy died from pneumonia, viral pneumonia, you know, serious pneumonia. And they're not checking. They're not doing the documentation that's required to specifically identify this virus. In addition to which, people are dying on the street, and they're just frankly collecting the bodies and taking them to what is essentially is a crematorium.
So bottom line is, you don't have any reason to doubt those reports. You think there's some merit to them.
Merit to the fact that the numbers are much greater in reality than they are on the official Chinese documents.
Wow, very interesting here. Michael, pick up on that, please, now, and where Ilana puts out there. She said some pretty startling things there when it comes to these numbers from the Chinese. And do we understand the nature of this crisis? Or,
Well, you know, I'm aware of that allegation. And you know, it's also received news lately because you had a Harvard head of chemistry department who had just been indicted by the Justice Department for cooperation with the university in this exact town of in Hubei province that, you know, is comprised like of 11 million people. You know, certainly when you're not allowing the CDC in to inspect and work with the peers in China to contain this, it sort of suggests that, yeah, maybe you're trying to conceal something.
Well, listen, before we jump into the Iowa caucuses and the rest with our distinguished panel here and talk to you further here, I want to take just a moment to tell you this is also, by the way, and I'm sure you know, Super Bowl weekend, Super Bowl 54. And it's interesting when you see the hype on Super Bowl, of course. It's an extraordinary event. Too bad they lost a lot of people when they pulled the kinds of shenanigans the football folks pulled. Or maybe they'd even have a larger audience at this point. And I can't let the opportunity pass by without commenting on that. But in any event, it is a money bonanza, to say the least. A 30-second slot on that game is $5.6 million. And you've got, in fact, President Trump's campaign will have a couple of spots, and Bloomberg will have some, and of course, the usual ones, Anheuser-Busch, Coca-Cola, you know, the usual people will be on there as well. But it's an expensive proposition. You certainly have to empty your piggy bank out to do business with the Super Bowl now, huh? Of course, how else you think they're going to pay those athletes, people, right? I mean, come on. Listen, there are other big stories we're going to talk about today on Viewpoint, such as the Middle East peace plan. And, of course, you see the United Kingdom and Brexit. I can't believe it's finally done. That's amazing here, you know. So instead of the normal break right now, I just want to take a moment to invite you all back live to America Out Loud and tell you more about some of the things we're doing here. You're listening to the voices today here on our top news here of Dr. Carol Swain. Colonel Jim Warshak, Michael Johns are with us here. But, you know, back at AmericaOutLoud.com, we have an extraordinary, and the word is extraordinary, array of talent and people from around the world, actually, who bring us the best in blogs and columns and show hosts and talk radio, podcast, you name it, videos, it's all back there at AmericaOutLoud.com. There's great conversations going on. The important thing is I want you to know that your job now is to take that information and put it out there in the big world and share the wealth of information. We are a grassroots movement and a public asset for patriots and Americans and people really from around the world, as our audience is a global audience, clearly. But you'll find news blogs, podcasts, talk radio, video, it's all back there. We take on the challenges of our generation here, friends, so we can preserve future generations. We are a daily resource, so take advantage of that back there at AmericaOutLoud.com. Also want to give a quick shout out to Lieutenant Joseph Pangaro, who has been guest hosting this program for me and done a fine job over the past 5 weeks that my voice has not been on the program here. We appreciate him. He is the host of Chasing Justice, 3 p.m. on America Out Loud Daily. You'll catch that program here. So let's bring it back now, and I want to talk to you next, friends, about the Iowa caucuses here as we bring our panel back on here. Joining us back here again is Dr. Carol Swain. Michael Johns is here, and Colonel Jim Warshuk as we continue on here. Now, listen, there's no shortage of news here. The Iowa caucuses are in play. They happen to be Monday, February 3rd, as I say. The State of the Union is Tuesday, February 4th. Hopefully, the president's acquittal is on the 5th, Wednesday, although I do still question people why McConnell didn't pull the lever. I don't know that I agree with the panel on that, but that's beside the point, isn't it now? I've got to a point of life that I think you don't give the far-left socialists an inch anymore because they tend to take a mile when you give them that. And I have a sense we need to close them down. Well, listen, talking about the Iowa caucuses, let's talk about that now. So listen, 27 Democrats have had their names in the 2020 mixed at one point or another. Now, that's a record. That's a record. And these are the people who were laughing at the Republicans back there in 2016, you remember, when Trump took them out one by one, you know. And this is a record, and more than the last four contested campaigns combined. Now, many have already quit the race. Many more will make that choice after Iowa and New Hampshire weigh in is what normally happens here. Now, you have another factor here. Colonel Jim, let's get you to start here the conversation. Let's wind up here. But listen, Super Tuesday is coming fast, March 3rd. Now, you got Bloomberg hanging out there that is pouring money like a sieve. He is just throwing money left and right. And number one, can he be a factor? Number two, the Democrat establishment seems to be getting more apprehensive and scared of Bernie Sanders. You see, they just changed the rules of the debates now. They are trying to find a way to pull Bernie down, many people believe. What's your thoughts about the caucuses coming up in Iowa and how the Democrats are looking, Jim?
Well, you have a Democratic Party. You have certain candidates like Joe Biden, and you have Michael Bloomberg, who are all working against any unity within the Democratic Party because they all have their own agendas. Bloomberg, as you addressed, he's playing on the outside. He's going to spend a lot of money. I don't know how effective it will be. Most of it will be commercials. He's going to be actually competing with another wealthy Democrat billionaire by the name of George Soros is doing his thing. So there's really not a lot of coordinated and corroborated effort. You have lots of money and a number of people who are all doing their own thing. So I think you're going to see this is going to come down to a lot of disunity. I think you're going to have a lot of people angry at the caucus, mainly because of the outcome of the impeachment trial. And you're going to, you know, I was talking to one person. I said, it's really going to be an insane asylum of demonic and delusional people running around who are angry. They're angry at Trump. Some of them are going to be angry at their own party. I think we'll probably lose a few along the way. I don't think it will help Bloomberg. I think he may go the way of Stiers, a little bit of hype at the beginning, but I don't think he is really a serious contender, even though he's got a lot of money. People just don't care for him or something like that.
Well, he's not warm and fuzzy, Jim, for sure.
No, not at all. Fuzzy,
you know, kind of guy here. Let's get it over, bring Michael in, and Michael, get you to opine a minute here. You, a couple of things here I've mentioned to you. I mentioned Bernie Sanders. The establishment and the DNC looks like they're very concerned with Bernie. You got Elizabeth Warren, who's fading a bit, but still is part of the Looney Tune program there. And now you've got exactly the Bloomberg factor. Could there be a contested convention, number one? And two, what do you think of that, Michael? How afraid is the establishment on the left worried about Bernie Sanders?
Well, I think the Iowa caucus is the sort of undertaking that a candidate like Sanders is going to do well in, because it's less about TV advertising and you know, that 30,000 foot view approach to campaigning and more about on the ground organization. And that clearly has been the strength of the Sanders campaign in 2020, like it was in 2016. You know, there's a relative small amount of delegates at stake, but that can be underestimated, because my own experience in these cycles is that Iowa and then New Hampshire are both really important, because well, you don't need to win both of them. If you're not sort of coming in one or two in them, your national sort of perception as a viable candidate begins to dry up a bit. That affects fundraising. It affects volunteers and the perception of being, you know, a credible candidate who could secure the nomination begins to wane, which is one of the reasons I think I mentioned to you before. I think it's troubling to have Bloomberg basically skipping out on these first few and expecting that he can come in with a Super Tuesday strategy. I'm not aware of any history of that actually working. Furthermore, if you look back on the last 10 presidential elections, seven of the 10 Democrat nominees prevailed in Iowa. So winning Iowa is a very constructive sign from the standpoint.
Hey, Michael, one last question for you on that, on this caucus thing here. What do you think the chances are between now and November that Hillary Clinton will come riding in on her white horse to save the DNC?
This is just my opinion. I mean, who knows what the answer to that is? I think it's minimal, simply because, you know, that would be her third candidacy. She's developed a lot of resentment within the Democrat Party. I think there's still a lot of concern, particularly about the way she and the DNC treated Bernie Sanders in 2016. And I think the country's just sort of heard and seen enough of her.
Yeah,
I think that's
sure.
part of the problem. Frankly, I think that's true of her. I think it's also true of Joe Biden. I mean, if I asked,
yeah, that's right.
you know, even a knowledgeable political insider to describe to me what the Joe Biden policy agenda was for the country, it's sort of
but you know that Hillary
is difficult to articulate,
but you know she's sitting home on her sofa there, or whatever she does in her spare time, biting her lip that she's not running here in 2020 for certain. And the point of that is, with the lineup that they have there, it's not exactly an all-star lineup, quite frankly. Dr. Carol Swain, listen, I want to talk to you. We just talked about the caucuses and the election coming up here, but let me take it one step further with you, please. Gallup has a poll out on Americans' satisfaction on the issues. It's more or less a study, if you will, of looking at the various major factors that we would vote with. And I want everybody to listen to this now. This is really quite interesting, and Americans' satisfaction on the issues. So this is what they have to contend with, Carol, and here it is here. The state of the U.S. economy, 68% of Americans are thrilled with that. And by the way, and let me give you the numbers back in January 2017. That's up, Carol, from 46%. Here's another one for you. Security from terrorism. Americans are thrilled, 68%. That's up from 50% back in 2017. Military strength. Get ready for this one. 81% of Americans are happy with the performance, 66% back in 2017. And the state of race relations is up, and policies on reducing crime are up. Carol, that's a record to run against. I mean, how do they do it?
They do it by making the focus on the president's character rather than all the tremendous things he's actually accomplished. They can't run against him based on the state of the nation or the state of the union. So it has to be personalized.
Now, what you just said explains a lot, Carol. You know, that's the million-dollar point you just made. Because what you're saying is that is the reason they're acting so crazy like they're acting, trying to get him out of there, right?
Yes. And I believe the Democratic Party is about to make the same mistake they made before with Bernie Sanders and his disillusioned supporters will either stay home or they'll support Donald Trump.
Right. A lot of them did last time, you're saying.
Yes, and they'll do the same thing this time. There's no reason for them to have confidence in Democrats or anything the Democrats say about fairness and the political process.
Well, see, that's the word they use a lot, fairness. They throw that around like a frisbee, and then they come back and they give the, and then the Republicans say, oh, we're not being fair. And then they get, which is why I said McConnell should have kicked him while he could and got that acquittal done before.
I disagree with you. And I know. I believe one of the reasons why he chose the path that he did is that the senators needed to get out of Washington to get to Iowa. Yeah. In fact, the president is going to have more than 80 people there on the ground working to get his message out.
But why do we care? Why do we care if they get to Iowa or not? Why do we give a rat's ass?
Because to the extent that they can,
I don't care.
Inspire the the enthusiasm for the people in Iowa. I mean, the president is campaigning; he's out there. Yeah. I think that they're making some good decisions, even though when you look at them on the surface, a lot of them don't seem to make a lot of sense.
No, they don't. But listen, if they're so worried about getting to Iowa, maybe Nancy Pelosi shouldn't have sat in this thing on the water cooler for 30 some odd days. Maybe they shouldn't have played the kinds of games they played.
Have no idea. Well, I mean, I believe they're confused, and
that's an understatement.
McConnell has given them enough rope to continue hanging themselves.
Glenn, now let's face the reality also, which is not spoken enough, that
what is it?
The sort of witnesses that they wanted to bring forward, as I mentioned, were individuals they did not call in the House, and they could not call in the House because of presidential
executive privilege.
And executive privilege,
of course. You know,
and they did not want to go. The final point on that is they did not want to go to court to litigate that. Because they had great concerns that they would lose it. And I think they would lose it. You can't compel a political appointee to testify against the president on private conversations, just like you couldn't bring forward Adam Schiff's legislative staff and start deposing them about private conversations he's had. That kind of gets to the core of separation of powers.
And Jim, let me give you the last word, please, on this SOTU, which we affectionately call the State of the Union, coming up here. As you stated earlier, there could be some surprises, or they could, you know, remember last time they wore all white gowns and they were in the audience heckling the president. And you remember the speaker even heckled him with her applause and her sarcasm up front. And that's before a lot of this damage has happened in the last, bit of time here. Jim, I think it could be quite interesting.
No, I think it's going to be a very to the point State of the Union. The president is going to lay out his accomplishments. He's going to lay out where he's going to go in the next 8, 9, 10 months until the election. And he is going to give a feeling of success so that people can take that back and say, you know, despite all the stuff we heard, he's been able to do what he has promised.
All right. Well, you're listening there, friends, again to the voices of Colonel Jim Warshak, Michael Johns, Dr. Carol Swain. We appreciate each of them in being here. There's a lot that's going to happen in the days, in the weeks ahead, friends, on this program here and certainly in this country. We will stay close to all of it, and we thank each of them for their input here on the program. Up next, friends, we're going to talk about that Middle East peace plan. There is other news going on in the world, by the way. And then you see Brexit. Wow, it finally happened, if you can believe that. Boris Johnson, he pulled the rabbit out of the hat. Can you believe that? Stay right there, friends, as Viewpoint rolls on.
The America Out Loud Talk Radio app is on Android or Apple. It's the perfect way to listen in to the new generation of talk shows and hosts who are ready to inform and inspire.
Spreading the out loud truth from sea to shining sea. AmericaOutloud.com is the voice of liberty and justice for all. The goal is to deliver a message of truth, inspiration, and hope to the world. To unite people from all backgrounds and beliefs in an effort to advance humanity. We are the vision of the voices. Welcome to the new era in communications. America Out Loud Talk Radio.
Think back to the last time you felt healthy and energized. The best times of our lives occur when we're at the peak of our health. sleeping better, full of energy and focus. We know that fades with age, and you might be feeling the effects of aging as low energy and poor sleep. But it doesn't have to be that way. There haven't been any nutrition systems designed to rejuvenate our bodies as we get older, until now. Healthy Cell Pro is the only multi-nutrient system that impacts the building block of your body, the cell. Created by anti-aging expert and Nobel Prize nominee, Dr. Vincent Giampapa, award-winning Healthy Cell Pro cuts through the complexity of nutrition supplements by simply giving you the purest ingredients, filling dietary gaps to nourish your cells and enhance your quality of life for optimal performance. Visit HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for an exclusive discount or call 844-869-9958.
One of the other big stories, I think, this week was very fascinating. The Middle East peace plan I want to talk to you about next, and then a little bit about Brexit, which I never thought I'd be saying these words, like it finally happened, you know, like, wow. But it did, it did. So joining us on now here is two of our best here. Dennis Santiago is here. He's a global risk and financial analyst. Focuses on asymmetric warfare, arms control, global stability. We'll tell you about a recent column he's got up there. And Ilana Friedman is back with us and really got such a big... The duo you're listening to now, Dennis and Ilana, I count on for so much of a lot of the news and information we bring you, friends, every day here. So Ilana is a veteran intelligence analyst. She is a political commentator here at America Out Loud. Always has an interesting take on things, as Dennis does as well. Proud and pleased to have both of them here and have them associated with our amazing platform here at America Out Loud, friends. So I want to start with this comment that was put out there about the Middle East peace plan. And let me just start here. I seen this comment that was put out on social media, and I captured it because I thought, you know, I want to ask Ilana and Dennis this. And here it is here. This guy says, I'm an Israeli Jew. I want to have peace. My Palestinian neighbors have rejected any peace offer we have made since 1948. How can we have peace when our neighbors want conflict? Dennis, answer that question first. How do we have peace when our neighbors want conflict?
If you look very carefully at this latest peace plan or peace proposal that has come out, we're going to impose peace on on the region. And it's kind of interesting because, you know, the imposition of peace in the Middle East is kind of popular right now. If you go north of the Israeli-Palestinian issue, you go up into Syria, and they're imposing peace there in certain parts of Syria. It's the Russians that are leading it up there. But here we are down a little closer to the Red Sea, and we are the ones that are now taking the position of imposing peace. If you look at that 181-page document, it doesn't ask Hamas squat of whether they want this or not. It just basically says, here's our plan, this is the way it's going to be, and you either follow or get out of the way.
I got to tell you, Ilana, as we open this up with you now, listen to this now. The Palestinian president came out, Mahmoud Abbas here. He says to the plan, he says now, very swiftly to Dennis's point there, 1,000 no's, 1,000 no's. The deal, the conspiracy will not pass. It will end up in the dustbin of history. So if you take that on one hand, not exactly encouraging words coming from him, and you take what Dennis just puts out there and says, well, but we're going to kind of mandate peace at this point. And they do that by getting a lot of the neighbors involved. How does that play out, Ilana?
The Palestinians have been canceling out every single peace plan that has come down through 70-odd years of history. They just refuse to do anything. They refuse to cooperate. They actually pay salaries to their terrorists who may or may not be in jail. They are just completely uncooperative. You can't have an agreement with only one side at the table. The Israelis are there. They've been there at every peace talk since the first one. You have to understand, I think, that the leadership of the Palestinians, both Hamas and the Palestinian Authority, they don't care what happens to their people. Right. They keep their people in poverty, and they steal money from humanitarian aid, and they enrich themselves and live in luxury while their neighbors live in squalor.
Right.
And that is those are the kind of people we're dealing with in this situation.
Well, and, you know, when you start to do the math on all of this and you realize that, you know, coming through a few facts here, Dennis, it is like you even say in a recent article you have on America Out Loud, which I'll tell folks about in a moment here. But, you know, you give some hope out there, but it's a long shot. And I think you say that in there pretty much, as Ilana's saying right now, it is a long shot. When you pose the question, Ilana, that you have to want peace, they've never really, I mean, if your real core is that you want to drive Israel off the map and you hate them that badly, then you really are not willing to come to the negotiating table. You really don't want to negotiate. And like Ilana says, they don't really care about their people. They've proven that before.
There's no hiding the fact that the Middle East is a very complex place. What Trump and Kushner have done is they're basically saying they want to recruit Israel, Egypt, and Jordan to be the protectorate overseers right. of this brand new Palestinian
state. I like that.
Right. So they are our enforcers by proxy. The Palestinians are kind of stubborn. They don't want to cooperate with anybody. They're kind of lost in their own little echo chamber. And so our strategy now is, okay, if you can't figure it out for yourself, we're going to get the people around you to figure it out for you. And then we're going to put a carrot in there that says, we're going to build you a viable economic state that you're not going to want to lose once you get it. So that's kind of the carrot and stick thing that's going on. It's got the attraction of the greater region, and it's got some attraction around the world, because to tell you the honest truth, the rest of the Middle East is kind of wary of this thing going on for so long. One of the key linchpins in this is that the Palestinians are dependent on the largesse of the Iranians. It's their money that's paying for Hamas to work. Mm-hmm. And we just changed that game because we killed Soleimani. Mm-hmm. All right. That entire Iranian Shia crescent thing is now at risk, and so is Hamas.
Yeah, it really is a smart plan, but it still is a long road ahead, isn't it, Ilana?
It is a long road, but let me just mention that from the point of view of security, Israel has been given the largest share of the security for what is going to be an Israel and a Palestinian state. They say that the Palestinian state, first of all, will be demilitarized. Hamas will be disarmed. Israel will retain security control on the entire west bank of the Jordan River. Everything from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea will be controlled. The security of that area will be controlled by Israel. And that's the first time in Israeli history that they have had this opportunity to maintain their own security with a border on the Jordan River. So this is not likely to be okay with the Palestinians. They don't want to be demilitarized. They've been practicing violent terrorism for generations.
That's right.
And they're not going to want to give up their guns. So this is another area of contention. I've seen all of the peace plans from beginning to end, and I lived through a lot of them.
Yes,
because I lived in Israel for 16 years.
Right,
and I have seen all this, and I have never seen a peace plan that has the best chance of being successful.
Wow.
Although I see an awful lot of problems along the way, roadblocks and issues and violence that's going to come along as a result of this peace plan. But I do believe it does have a possibility of success. And one of the things, by the way, at the presentation that the president gave Netanyahu, among the people who were attending were representatives of Oman, Bahrain, and the United Arab Emirates. That is huge. It's not getting very much coverage,
but
it is huge.
Does it succeed?
I think it does. It's a tough road, but this is the last time I saw a break in opportunity to bring peace to the Middle East that worked was Jimmy Carter, Begin and Sadat, and that worked. We can make it work again.
Interesting. And to hear both you, both Ilan and Dennis, have a mode of optimism is very striking to me, because I wasn't sure what you were going to say. But anyways, let me remind people now that you'll find write-ins on the platform on these topics very much from Ilana Friedman and Dennis Santiago. I want to ask you to share them with the world out there now. The one you'll read right now that's up there this morning here as you're listening to this on Sunday morning, friends, is Imposing the Mandated Solutions, Marks Trump's Fresh Thinking for the Middle East. Last story, friends, for the day here, I want to talk to you about a story I didn't think we would be talking to you about in our lifetimes. Brexit, it's official. The United Kingdom has left the European Union. Nigel Farage, the leader of the Brexit Party, and let's just say they got drunk over the last couple of days, people. You know, he said, we did it. We transformed the landscape of our country. And they started playing, Dennis, they were playing, we are the champions, and God save the Queen, and all that stuff.
The United Kingdom is going to find itself an even greater partner of the United States in the coming years, because it's now able to independently chart its course through the economic morass that Europe had become. The European Union became too codependent of a system, and it was dragging down the stable economies. And so the British were basically saving themselves from what was becoming a deeper and deeper morass. What will happen to the European Union now is what interests me more. I mean, the fate of England is pretty, we know which direction that's going to go. It's the fate of the European Union, you know, Macron and the German government. I mean, they're all now having to figure out, how are we going to do this when we have fewer rich countries to prop up this?
Well, you see those countries leaving? Because I'm seeing reports that a lot of these other countries are gonna pull out of there as well.
Yeah. I think, you know, if one succeeds, well, that's going to get the other ones to also ask the question. Yeah. Now, you know, and where that finally ends, does Europe devolve back into a bunch of little states? Their big fear in the EU is that unless they're together, they're not big enough to resist the economic power of the United States.
Well, that's the reason they became that. I remember as a young lad when that had happened. And I say really, really young lad, people, to emphasize that a moment here. But I remember when that happened that way. Hey, listen, Ilana, they are free of the European Union. What do you say to that?
It's awesome. I have never been a fan of the European Union because I have always felt that the nature of the individual countries, the collective nature of each country, is so different from its neighbor that there was no way that this could be a successful venture. And I think what we have seen is the collapse of one country after another after they joined the European Union. Now they are faced, we had Greece going into some subterranean debt, and we had Italy with all kinds of crises. Right. It's just been one thing after another. Mm-hmm. I think that this is that the United Kingdom is going to be the leader in an ongoing exit, country by country, from European Union.
Amen.
I forecast this in the beginning, and I'm very happy to see
it. Well, you forecasted right. I just hope you forecast the Middle East peace now, and that would be fabulous. Well, listen, big thank you to Ilana Friedman and Dennis Santiago, friends. Always enjoy having them here with us on Viewpoint this Sunday. Again, this program is successful because of you out there. So we ask you to share this far and wide and continue to. You'll hear this again every Sunday, 10 a.m. Sunday morning is the first airing. You'll hear the live program then. And then 6 p.m. is an encore version later in the day on America Out Loud Talk Radio. Goes to podcast 1 p.m. that afternoon, Eastern Time now. You'll catch it on the front page of AmericaOutLoud.com. You'll also catch all of these great people and all of our fabulous writers, bloggers, columnists, show hosts, a talk radio podcast, all of it back there, video as well, AmericaOutLoud.com. Join us and help us get the word out here. Friends, thank you for joining me here as always. It's time now to get involved and get loud.